always looked at so far in this course. So I'm going to really have to speed up the pace. But I explained that the classifications are overly simplistic, and I'm proposing that we look at these different apologists and look at what they're actually doing. And when you do that, you come up with a lot more methodologies than just four or five. And if you want to break it down to four or five, I'm okay with that. But include these subdivisions. Like, don't just say presuppositionalism and then act like all presuppositionalists are alike when Gordon Clark and Van Til almost wanted to kill each other. They had so much disagreement. And I'm exaggerating there, but just a little. So we looked at classical apologetics. For the most part, it's been the way the church has defended the faith for the past 2,000 years. And but then it's kind of like evidentialism. We kind of got less philosophical and more scientific. As a philosopher, I didn't mean that as a compliment, but we got away from philosophical type arguments and put heavier emphasis on the historical evidences. Okay? And so that for classical apologetics, it's a 1-2 approach, two-step approach. Argue for God, and then argue from history that Christianity is true, Jesus rose from the dead, he's God incarnate. Well, evidentialism focuses almost primarily on historical evidences. And then after doing that, some of them are willing to maybe argue for God on the side, but I'm telling you, many of the evidentialists are best friends with many of the classical apologists, so they're so close in their views. These guys come in the second half of classical apologetics anyway, so that to act like these guys are at war with each other. No. These guys sit down next to each other and they shoot the breeze and they're buddies. They hang out together. And then when you get presuppositionalism, if we're going to act like all these guys agree, no, Van Til and Clark would—they'd refuse to sit down and have a cup of coffee with each other. Okay, and then many of their disciples are not even really presuppositionalists; they're usually what I would call verificationalists. So we want to talk about evidentialism right now, and if we, because we're speeding up the pace, if we have time, we'll get to presuppositionalism today. And I've got like a little handout on presuppositionalism, which could speed up the process for us, which would be a really good thing. The historical apologetics of Joshua Dallas, what we want to talk about first, is evidentialism. So with evidentialism, the three main guys we're going to talk about, McDowell, Montgomery, great Lutheran scholar, still alive today. Gary Hagman, I spent all three of these guys are still alive. I won't be speaking there, but I'll have a table there and be able to spend a lot of time with speakers with Josh McGowan and son Sean. I met them at previous talks. Friends with Hagman. Never met Montgomery, talked to on the phone with him a few times. He was at Faith Seminary for a while. Josh McDowell, in the 1970s, he wrote Evidence That Demands a Verdict. That might be the most influential book on evidentialism or historical apologetics written during the 20th century. This book helped a lot of skeptics come to Christ and also encouraged many believers to study and do apologetics. When I got saved in 1981, if you wanted to learn about apologetics, anybody who was doing apologetics told you, okay, you got to read Josh McDowell. Okay? And then when they thought, okay, you could graduate from Josh McDowell stuff to C.S. Lewis stuff, or Chesterton stuff. But we're going to see that McDowell not only used historical apologetics, evidentialism. I use evidentialism and historical apologetics interchangeably. I use them as synonyms. Some apologists don't. But he was also willing to do cultural apologetics and comparative religious apologetics and even testimonial apologetics. We'll talk about those as well. Okay? McDowell provides a strong case that 66 books of the Protestant Bible comprise the true canon. In other words, the true list of the books that belong in the Bible. The extra Roman Catholic books fail these tests. He argues for Old Testament reliability by showing how meticulous the scribes were when they copied the Old Testament manuscripts, what their practices were. He also deals with the Dead Sea Scrolls and how they confirmed the accuracy of the copies of the standard, the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text that we have from about the 9th century AD. When you compare the two, you find out, the text has remained the same for well over 1,000 years. Then he also turns to archaeological finds that confirm the general historical accuracy of the Old Testament. So yeah, each sentence that I'm giving you here is evidence that demands a verdict. You got like an entire chapter on it. Now he has revised and updated that, so that's something to look into. His more than a carpenter.
Yeah.
I think that's up about probably 50 to 60 million copies now. It was such a small book. There he argued just for the deity of Christ and his resurrection. We used that in Bible 9 when you were there. Little book more than a carpenter. If I taught you Bible 9, I used it. Because I never taught Bible 9 without using it.
Huh.
I used that with the Philip Yancey book.
Yeah,
because you remember his hair.
Yeah.
See, that's when Dallas just had an afro. That had a bigger impact. Okay, McDowell also established the reliability of the New Testament. He knew that Christianity was rooted in history, and so he says that when historians claim that you can't know the Jesus of history, they're not being honest. We don't have any of the original writings, so we can't know anything about Jesus. But we don't have any of the original writings of anything from the first century A.D., yet we have a lot of historical knowledge from the first century A.D. I mean, to this day, they're biased. I mean, some New Testament scholars won't accept something unless it has multiple attestation, multiple sources, or at least passes one of their other biased tests. Yet, almost everything we know from 1st century A.D. is based on one source. So they have a double standard, and McDowell calls them out for them. McDowell will spell it out where, you know, there exist over 24,000 copies now. I think we're up to about 26,000. 5,000 of them in the original Greek. And, you know, with Plato's writings, you only have 7 handwritten copies. Homer's Iliad was at about 643, now I think it's over 800. But basically, Homer's Iliad's in second place. So out of all ancient literature, by far, the New Testament has way more copies, okay? And then when you compare these copies, you've got a better shot at figuring out what the original says. Now, the other thing is, too, is that, so you've got the number of copies. And so for a New Testament, McGowan said 24,000, well, we found more since then. With Homer's Iliad, 643, but now it might be around 800. But that's second place of all ancient literature. So there's a huge, huge gap there. With the gap between the copies and when the originals were supposedly written, what's the oldest fragment that you have? With the New Testament, you know, I would argue that we're probably looking at 20 to 40 years, because there's some manuscripts, some fragments that we found that Carson Pichini and papyrologists have argued that should be dated all the way back to the pre-70s AD. So, in fact, even Chester Beatty Papyrus contains all four Gospels. It's usually dated to late 2nd century, so like 170 to 190 AD. But there's a Korean, South Korean papyrologist that says, no, the style of writing is much more consistent with the 90s AD. So, but if you go, nobody disputes John Ryland's fragment of John chapter 18, Jesus before Pontius Pilate, that was found in Egypt, and nobody debates that dates to 125 to 135 AD at the latest. So if you take a late date of John's Gospel, say 90 AD, and this date's about 130 AD, you got like 25 to 40 years in there. You're getting really, really close. Now, having said that, though, there are some that argue John Ryland's fragment would be much more properly dated to the 90s AD, which is the 90s AD, and it's in Egypt. John's Gospel was probably written.
Now, how do we know that's not an original, not a copy, but could be an original?
Just by being in Egypt, it's not an original. There would be no way the early church, and it wouldn't be in Rome, the Roman Catholic Church would think, well, that's the most important. Even Tertullian said, 221 AD, what indeed has Athens to do with Jerusalem? So Jerusalem still, even though it was pretty much uninhabited or scarcely populated, it was still considered Jerusalem. If you pick one city to represent Christianity, it wasn't Rome. But it would be somewhere in the Israel, maybe, I don't know, I'd like to say Antioch or Syria, but basically, Tertullian said that there were the authentic copies, the authentic writings were still, I don't remember where he said they were, but that he had the authentic copies. And, see, the Antioch of Syria church, that's what President Obama, former President Obama, would have liked us to, if we really took out Syria, ISIS is just shredding the Syrian church. And that's the longest standing church as far as it's continuous. And, but whatever the case, I agree with Dean Bergen of the 19th century that the early church scribes, by the way, I think you had authorized New Testament scribes and unauthorized New Testament scribes. Okay? An unauthorized New Testament scribe, if I'm a wealthy man and they show me a copy of John's Gospel, and I don't have anybody who's like the church has said, yeah, this guy is a real professional scribe. If I got anybody who knows Greek, I'm going to make a copy, have to make a copy of it, okay? And that's why I think you see so many misspellings and things like that. So I think they knew when you had almost a perfect authorized copy and when you had a lousy copy. Like City Athens, Vaticanus, about 350 AD, they're supposed to be the two best full manuscripts in the New Testament that we have. And City Athens, I think there's like thousands of corrections in the Because they, whoever had it knew he had a lousy copy. And so whenever somebody would come to town and have a better copy of the Gospel of John, they'd make the corrections. They had a better copy, you know. So, but the Jews, when they had, they would copy an original when it was starting to fall apart. And then they would burn it in a respectful ceremony so that it wouldn't end up in a garbage can.
Part of the Jewish heritage, yeah. They used to do that with the Old Testament.
Yeah, they did something to do with the Old Testament. I think that Dean Burton was right that the authorized scribes did that with the New Testament. So a lot of these older fragments are good evidence for how far back the originals go, but that doesn't mean that those are really good copies. Just the fact that they existed that long should make us question how valuable were they considered back then, especially when some of them have corrections were being made to them. And, yeah, there's a lot of work being done now. We've got a new technology where we can take, there's like, they have a paper mache, like death masks in Egypt, and they just use scrap paper. Well, some of the scrap paper they use are sometimes Bible manuscripts. And so now we're starting to find stuff, and they're getting really early days. I don't know. It's probably too quick to use that as evidence. But believe me, with the technology that we have, we can get fragments that are like, you just touch them and they disintegrate. And there's still ways now to, we're getting the technology to where we can now decipher these. Whereas before, there's nothing you could do with them. Once you touch them, once you bring them out into the air, they just disintegrate. So, with Plato's writings, he only has 7 copies, and the gap is 1,200 years. Homer's Iliad is about 500 years, and that again is second place. Then with the accuracy, the agreement of the copies, the New Testament, Bruce Metzger of Princeton, Bart Ehrman's mentor, said the New Testament had 99.5% accuracy, whereas Homer's Iliad, 95%, second place. They don't even bother giving you a total for Plato, probably because they're all copies done by the same scribe. And so when you have this many copies and that much agreement, you can figure out, you know, in other words, 99.5% agreement with 26,000 copies, you can be pretty confident you have 100% accurate. You've replicated the original. And so what the only debate is, are you going to favor the majority of the manuscripts or the older manuscripts? Now, I'll favor the older ones if everything else was equal. But we go too quick with it. So in other words, either the New American Standard is almost an exact replica of the originals translated into English, or the New King James Version is almost an exact replica. Because the New King James is based on the majority of the manuscripts. The New American Standard and all other modern English translations are based on the older manuscripts that they're finding, which I think those manuscripts are not tested, to be honest with you. I think the more we test them, the more we question them. So then you get the widespread distribution of the New Testament. And so basically what he's saying is, when we look at our New Testament, contrary to what the baloney that Bart Ehrman is proclaiming, he knows better too. And he says, oh, there's between 200,000 and 400,000 variants, discrepancies in the copies. That's more than there are verses in the New Testament. And then he just walks away like he leaves us in our skepticism. A New Testament scholar like him knows, wait a minute, when you do textual criticism, if you have that many copies, that many variants are not that bad. It's especially when most of them are just misspelled words. So, you know, if it says Jesus went to Bethsaida and the guy updates the name to Bethesda or whatever, or if the guy misspells it, that doesn't even change our English translation. So if it doesn't even change the meaning, or if it's in such a late copy and there's only a few of them, that's not even viable. It's like, yeah, there's no chance that was it. But when you get just the meaningful ones that change the meaning, variants, discrepancies in the copies that change the meaning, or and are also good candidates for the original, both meaningful and viable, that's when you get down to only 99.5% agreement. So out of every 1,000 words, how many would be called into question here? 5. Okay? Homer's Iliad, at every 1,000 words, how many would be called into question?
Roughly 10.
50.
All 50, yeah.
Because 95 out of 100, so it'd be 950 out of 1,000. So 99.5% and 95% look pretty close. But it's not close when it's textual criticism. Textual criticism is when you compare copies to try to reproduce the original. And so what that means is the New Testament is 10 times more accurate than second place of all ancient literature going back to the first century AD. And when there's only 5 words every 1,000, you can pretty much figure out who got it wrong. And so that's why it just comes down to when it comes to how are you reasoning? Are you reasoning, well, older is better, period? Then you're gonna settle on the New American Standard. But if you're saying, wait a minute, these guys were not fools. They knew the difference. Even Tertullian, 221 AD, they knew the difference between good copies and not so good copies. So they're going to keep copying the good copies. So what's going to be handed down all the way on up to the reformers, they were using the majority text. So, now, there are a lot of conspiracy theorists who, by the way, I think McDowell favors the newer translations and the older, but almost everybody, I'm in the minority when I argued that point. But whatever the case, I don't buy into the conspiracy theories that guys are purposely changing the copies and this and that. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, I just find it real questionable. Okay, but McDowell says, look, if you trust anything in the first century AD, you ought to trust the New Testament. Now, all he's establishing is that the text is the copy, the New Testament that you read today is a reliable reproduction of what the original actually said. Okay? And then he talks about some of the leading...
So he's talking about King James? The New King James or Standard or...
I think the King James and the New King James are based on the best manuscript. This is based on the majority. This is based on the received text, which is almost identical to the majority of the manuscripts, okay? And, but the New American Standard, the NIV, the Catholic New American Bible, the New English Version, you know, list goes on and on. All these extra ones, they're not going just with the older manuscripts, period, but that holds the most weight for them. Whereas before Tischendorf and Tregelles, Westcott and Port, in the late 1800s, they were supposed to just update the English of the King James. But one of those guys was allowed by the Vatican to see Vaticanus. So he really wanted to promote that. Another one had access. access to Thucydides, and he wanted to promote that. And so they were supposed to just update the English of the King James Version when they made the, what's it called? The revised Standard Version. They were supposed to just update the English. Instead, what they did was they went to a whole different Greek text. And that's what the newer translation have been doing ever since. What the guys from the New King James Version, like Dr. James Borland of Liberty University, what they said was, no, look, let's do what these other guys were supposed to do over 100 years ago. Let's update the English of the King James without going to a Greek text based on untested manuscripts. But whatever the case, McDowell's going to be on this side probably, where I'm on this side, but I'm in the minority, but I just think I'm right. Then McDowell talks about Jesus and he says, look, and he uses C.S. Lewis's argumentation here. He says, look, no good man would ever claim to be God. So Jesus did not give us the option. So now what you have is an accurate, a reliable New Testament telling us that Jesus claimed to be God. Okay? So if Jesus claimed to be God, Jesus could not be a good man. Okay? You know, what if I claim to be God, he was saying, yeah, how's your apologetics professor at Shepherd's Bible College? So, oh, he's a good man. He's got one problem, though. He claims to be God all the time. Well, no. If you're claiming to be God, you're not merely a good man. You're either God, or you're a liar, or you're a lunatic. Okay? And so he takes the Lord, liar, lunatic trilemma, okay? A fourth one you could add nowadays would be legend. That's the Jesus myth hypothesis. I just spoke on that in Minnesota. I've been lecturing that where people think Jesus was borrowed from pagan myths, and these guys are just promoting mythology. But C.S. Lewis, as an expert in classics, just see through that. But McDowell is just Lord, liar, lunatic. The legend hypothesis, you could argue that McDowell already silenced that just by his New Testament reliability argumentation. Okay? I'll be writing a paper to present in Texas for the National Meeting of the International Society of Christian Apologetics on the Jesus Myth Hypothesis. So we'll get something in print for the Shepherd students eventually on that. Right now, you can just go online and watch. Pat's uploading so many of my thoughts. I give numerous talks on it, but the one where I'm doing the PowerPoint, the latest one's on the Jesus Myth Hypothesis that probably from a year or two ago.
We're in Texas.
That's Plano, Texas. I don't even know where Plano, Texas is. He basically argues that, look, Jesus is either Lord, liar, or lunatic, and then he gives reasons why nobody wants to believe Jesus is a liar or a lunatic, and therefore Jesus is God. Now, if you provide evidence for the resurrection first, then it would be, well, why would God raise a liar from the dead? Why would God raise a lunatic from the dead? We've historically proven he rose from the dead, so he's not a legend, so he must be God. Okay? And so McDowell uses the Lord, liar, and lunatic, the trilemma, and he shows also that Jesus fulfilled numerous Old Testament prophecies written hundreds of years before Jesus was born, proving Jesus to be the Jewish Messiah, the one God anointed and selected to rescue Israel. He gives hundreds of prophecies. Let me just say this. Many of these prophecies he gives are not even prophecies. they're just like little... God apparently likes detective novels. Because he gives clues. And so there are times when it's not really a prediction. David's describing something he's going through, or another psalmist, or whatever. And you just look at it, and after Jesus fulfills it, you say, hey, wait a minute. That was talking about Jesus. And so you'll have, probably 100 or so prophecies that Jesus fulfilled, but you also have types that Jesus fulfilled, like the temple and the temple furniture and the animal sacrifices and all. But you'll also have in the history of the Jewish nation. The history of the Jewish nation is also pregnant with clues to the Messiah. So that when Hosea is saying that God called his son out of Egypt, he's talking about Israel. When Jesus had to go to Egypt as a baby for protection from King Herod and then came back, Matthew said, see, that was fulfilled. God called his son out of Egypt. Now, maybe with our modern hermeneutical principles, we might say, no, he's misinterpreting that passage. Now, from the Jewish mindset, Messiah is the ultimate Israelite, the ultimate Jew. And so the history of the Jewish nation, where Israel was in bondage and suffered, and then was set free. Or Israel suffered and then eventually exalted under King David and Solomon. We see the suffering Messiah and the exalted Messiah. But he gives hundreds of these prophecies. Evans said the man's a verdict, either the original, I have both. And I'm not giving away either one, so it might not be a good idea, it might be a good idea to get copies of both there. Then McDowell also confirmed Jesus' deity by providing evidence for Jesus' resurrection. He does there. This is the older way to defend the resurrection, that the resurrection accounts either the apostles were lying or they were deceived, or they were telling the truth, and Jesus rose. Now, they were not lying because men do not, they not only claim to see the empty tomb, they claim to see the risen Christ. They weren't lying because men do not die for what they know to be a lie. Okay? I mean, people die for lies all the time, but they don't know that they're lies. But if you're lying, you know it's a lie. Okay? So they weren't lying. Maybe they were deceived. Well, if they were deceived, it can't be like just the wrong tomb theory or somebody stole the body, because then you only have an empty tomb. You don't have the post-resurrection appearances. So for the deception, you've got to say that somehow the body was missing. They didn't know how it was missing. And then they hallucinated because they saw Jesus. And that's disproven. Now there's way more evidence than McDowell had access to, more psychological evidence. But back then, they already knew that groups of people do not share the same hallucination. Hallucinations are like dreams. If all six of us were asleep and were dreaming, we'd be having six different dreams. Okay? If we're not having six different dreams, we know something supernatural is going on. Either God or the demonic realm is trying to. But with the apostles, they're not deceived. They saw Jesus in groups. They were sincere enough to die for these beliefs. And so it just comes down to, in the end, Jesus was telling the truth. Okay? By the way, somebody might say, hey, wait a minute there. I heard what you were saying, Fernandez, that if we all had the same dream, that it could have been supernatural or demonic, okay? It doesn't have to come from God. What a miracle could come from the other side. Well, that's what the ancient Jewish argument against Jesus was that they couldn't deny his miracles. So they said he was a sorcerer. Biblical text says they said he was demon-possessed. And why in the world would Satan deceive the apostles into thinking Jesus rose when he didn't rise? That's counterproductive to Satan's mission. And why would Satan deceive the apostles by supernaturally raising Jesus from the dead, supposing he could do that? That's just all counterproductive, so it becomes really, really clear. And again, getting back to Jesus, if it's going to be satanic miracles that prove Jesus, then he would be a liar, and nobody wants to put him in that category. So the character of Jesus really helps make this trilemma and this trilemma a lot more powerful. Okay? The resurrection of Caesar Nero, which never really occurred, but if it did, I'm demonic. I'm like 100% sure about that. But if it's Jesus of Nazareth who's raised from the dead, it's pretty clear which side that is as well. And by the way, all the guys that are trying to deny the resurrection are almost always rejecting miracles altogether. So, okay, he even deals with all the alternative naturalistic theories to try to explain away the resurrection. Now, after making a strong historical case for Christianity, he then engages in testimonial apologetics. So now keep in mind, we covered classical apologetics, we covered evangelism, but some classical apologists, like David Clark, like dialogical apologetics, so we covered that real quick. And then the cumulative case of Feinberg, okay? So now we got three. We're covering evidentialism, that's four. We're going to see there's actually three different types of presuppositional apologetics that we're going to get to. But now, with Josh McDowell, he also uses testimonial apologetics. Testimonial apologetics is when you defend the faith by telling how Jesus changed your life, or how Jesus supernaturally intervened in your life. Could be answered prayer. You could have been healed of cancer or something. Okay? We'll get to that later in this course. We'll talk about different cases of testimonial apologetics. Well, not only is Josh McDowell an evidentialist, but he does give some testimonies, and then he gives his own testimony as well. And Paul would give his testimony as evidence that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah and the Savior and God incarnate. Okay? And McDowell does that. He also uses an approach that I would call comparative religious apologetics. That's his work, Handbook of Today's Religions. Handbook of Today's Religions, where he just tells you about basic world religions, non-Christian cults, the occult, and even secular religions, okay? And then he gives you a Christian response to them. And so that's what I would call comparative religious apologetics. Now on this I don't go into great detail on his dealing with the cults, because most of that information he's getting from guys like Walter Martin anyway. So we get to Walter Martin and his use of comparative religious apologetics, we'll deal with that. But he covers Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and other religions as well. You can read this in your textbook and see how he deals with this. Our Course in World Religions was, the way I handle it, is somewhat of a comparative religious apologetics, okay? So when you get a chance, make sure you read that chapter. You're actually supposed to read the whole book anyway, and you'll see how he uses comparative religious apologetics. But McDowell doesn't even stop there. He and Bob Hostetler have authored numerous books that I would call cultural apologetics. Like in his book, The New Tolerance. I think he wrote that in 1998, way ahead of his time, showing that traditional tolerance. Here's a quote from pages 19 and 20 from that book. In contrast to traditional tolerance, which asserts that everyone has an equal right to believe or say what he thinks is right, the new tolerance, the way our children are being taught to believe, says that what every individual believes or says is equally right and equally valid. So not only does everyone have an equal right to his beliefs, but all beliefs are equal, all values are equal, all lifestyles are equal, all truth claims are equal. But then, they go far enough to say, oh, by the way though, if you disagree with us, we can't tolerate you. So traditional tolerance, you tolerated with law-abiding citizens who disagreed with you, or had different beliefs, maybe even some different practices and behaviors, but they didn't infringe on other people's rights. So you tolerated, traditional tolerance, you tolerated people who disagreed with you. The new tolerance, you only tolerate those who agree with you. Well, that's traditionally what we've called intolerance, okay? And so classifying Josh McDowell's apologetic methodology, he is first and foremost an evidentialist, okay? He uses historical evidences, sorry, for the truth of Christianity. Notice, no arguments for God's existence there, okay? Then he's also willing to use testimonial apologetics, comparative religious apologetics, and cultural apologetics, okay? So that's Josh McDowell. Now we'll talk, we'll take about 5 minute break to about 3 minutes after 7. Then we'll talk about John Ward Montgomery, and we're not going to be able to spend too much time on him. And then we'll get into Gary Habermas, make a few comments there. And so hopefully by the third lecture of the night, hopefully we'll be talking about presuppositional apologetics.